Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today graduated from UC Berkeley, then went on to study world religions at the UC Santa Barbara's PhD program in religious studies. Gail Kimball created a course on women in religion when she was hired to teach at California State University, Chico. She has written books to give voice to the unheard, such as Global Youth, Egalitarian Couples, and Visionary Scientists. Gail Kimball has now published her 26th book, World Religions in Microcosm, Family Practices Globally. Gail Kimball, welcome.
I don't know why it's funny, but thank you, Nancy. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, what about this title, World Religions in Microcosm? What do you mean by that?
I was interested in how the religious beliefs play out in actuality. So what are families doing with it? And so I interviewed 28 people from 13 countries to see how their practices have changed since they were young, how they teach their children. And I'm always interested in politics, so I'm also interested in how religion influences the political scene, and Trump is a great example of that.
Well, then that gives us kind of a clue as to how you have your book organized, but how did you organize this book?
The first chapter is an overview about the current issues like growing secularization, increasing number of nuns, people who don't go to church.
Now, maybe you better spell that.
Not N-O-N-E-S.
Yes. Not increasing number of N-U-N-S, just
Catholics,
the opposite.
No.
But nuns meaning people who say, nope, none religion for me.
Right.
No religion.
Right. But on the other hand, maybe 22% of the people call themselves spiritual but not religious. So I was interested in why the growing secularization, the loneliness epidemic, mental health epidemic, including in youth, and what are the possible solutions. So that was my overview chapter. And then I organized it by indigenous religions, which to me the most interesting because I knew the least. So I interviewed two African tribal members.
You mentioned, too, that nowadays we capitalize that word indigenous.
Well, in Australia they do, but in the U.S. we don't.
Mm-hmm. Wait, okay. Now, so you have these chapters, but in your before you even start telling about these other people, you do include a note about yourself and your background.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe yourself as eclectically spiritual.
Yeah, like many people. So many of us are spiritual, but not religious in terms of affiliation with one particular group. But I consider myself very fortunate because I and my brother were raised in the Church of Religious Science, which is now called Center for Spiritual Enrichment. And it was all about God loves you, Jesus loves you, your life is created by your thought and your actions. They didn't use the word karma, but they meant that. And there was none of the sin, guilt, shame. You should be worried if you have a venial sin or a mortal sin. Are you going to go to hell or purgatory? Or we didn't have any of that. Very lucky. Yeah.
So you say in your book that you and your brother were raised in the Church of Religious Science, which taught us how our positive thoughts create our life.
Absolutely.
So you're just a kid when you're already picking up on this, that your thoughts play such a big role.
Oh, yes.
So and positive then, thoughts create your life.
Absolutely. And I think the consciousness revolution that's occurring because of quantum mechanics, the science that opposes strict materialism, you're only a bag of hormones and chemicals that fall apart and are destroyed once you die. The consciousness revolution backs up this belief that our thoughts are very powerful. There are all kinds of really triple-blind studies that indicate the power of thought.
Now, you just used a word that scientists can't even agree what it means. You said
consciousness.
Why can't scientists agree on the word? On the meaning of consciousness.
I did a trilogy where I interviewed visionary scientists. I call them physicians, PhDs, physicists, and they all said that it's ineffable. It's very hard to define, and they use many different words. And it's interesting that my interviewees in this book, World Religions and Microcosm, use the same kind of words of the field, energy, source, ineffable, mystery, those kind of words that are akin to quantum mechanics.
So I'll remind listeners of the title of your book, World Religions in Microcosm, Family Practices Globally, and the author is Chico author Gail Kimble. Now, you also say that both you and your brother find inspiration from hiking in Mother Nature.
Yes.
And that comes up often in your book, too, this relationship to... we mentioned the Australian person you interviewed, and they even have a different name for it.
Tyson Yunkaporta, who I fell in love with, and I think readers will fall in love with, he's brilliant Australian Aboriginal, he talks about the law of the land and the biology of where we were born. I don't exactly understand this concept, but he says where we are born influences us for the rest of our lives in a kind of biological way. And so we need to get into our affinity with the land where we live and where we came from. That he calls it the law of the land.
Law of the land. Well, there... Reading your book, I would slow because I would stop and think about things.
Oh, good.
You have a lot of percentages, polls, and it's also recent. Gail, you must spend your whole—do you ever eat and sleep?
Because I hike. I dance. I garden.
Because this is a 400-page book, and it's all recent information. I was surprised at how recent this information is in your book. And you have a lot of— information that I reacted to emotionally. Some of it made me happy. Some of it made me mad. Some of it made me think, wow, we need to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, for example, a statistic in your book. Now, all of us taxpayers would be shocked. I think the average taxpayer spent $5,109 on military,
mm-hmm.
which is more than on Medicare and Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
That's just last year.
Mm-hmm. You know, I hear conservatives often say, we spend so much of our money helping others abroad, we should spend it here. But actually, I think it's like 2% or something that we spend on foreign aid and helping others, USAID and those kind of groups. So, yeah, military is the big gobbling up of I mean, think how much is spent on a drone or a missile or a sub. It's horrendous.
I've been shocked when I hear those numbers.
Yeah.
But then I think, oh, just a little bit of that could go to National Public Radio.
Or schools that are the bathrooms
really
don't work.
Yeah, really, schools. That was my number one reaction besides you're mentioning Medicare and Medicaid. So if we are, I don't know if I'm going to say relying on religion, what is the problem that we seek out religions to solve for us? So what's
meaning? I think everyone asks, why are we here? And I did a long time ago, I did a study of global youth, and I asked them, if you could ask a question of the wisest person on the planet, what would you ask her or him? And I was surprised at how many asked, why are we here? And what happens after we die? Because you don't think of children, young people, as thinking about the afterlife. But from a young age, I found they really are trying to understand, why are we here?
So that's kind of the basic overall, the big question that people want to know. But then I think through history, too, different religions viewed our problem. Well, we're sinful. That's our problem. Or another religion could have a different view of what the problem is. So then I think they would have a different goal when you practice your religion, what are you trying to accomplish? What's your goal in practicing any particular religion? What are some examples?
Well, there's a debate among religious studies scholars, people like Houston Smith, who influenced my religious beliefs when I read his book, Religions of Man, when I was a teenager. Ah, Buddhism, Hinduism, I get it. He and others say all the religions have the similar theme of there's an afterlife, you're judged in some ways in terms of how you live this life, and there is God and a higher spirit. And then Stephen Prothero.
You know, before you leave Houston Smith, I think you might tell us again who he is and what this book is you referred to, because I think if anybody's interested in religion at all, this is really a go-to book. Mm-hmm. And so would tell us a little bit more.
Well, it was called Religions of Man, and it's changed. And I don't remember the current title because they were trying to be more less sexist. Mm-hmm. But he's a very interesting man because he was raised in a Methodist missionary family in China as a Methodist. But then he started studying world religions and was influenced by them. And I start the book with a quote from him, if you want to read it or have me read it. He says, "We're a blend of dust and divinity." That's kind of interesting. "The true measure of a religion is the way it transforms lives. Religion should be a source of joy and liberation. At the core of every religion is love and compassion for all beings." I think that really says it. It's beautiful.
Yeah. And this was Houston Smith's words that Gail was reading. I once had a class briefly where we used that book, Houston Smith's book, and we invited people from the community. We invited the rabbi to speak to us. We invited a Buddhist to speak to us. And I found that so interesting to meet these people. And I was so taken by them. I could see, I really like this person.
Mm-hmm. And they all have a similar one sentence summary: "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you."
Yes.
But
go ahead.
What's interesting is Islam, which we know is the fastest growing religion. There's much less emphasis on free will in this lifetime. It's Inshallah Allah, however you pronounce it. Inshallah Allah, which means God's will. And Muslims say that all the time.
You don't make plans unless Allah wills it.
Right. But on the other hand, if you sin, then you're going to go to hell. So I don't quite see how that works.
Well, you just briefly mentioned in passing that is the world's fastest growing religion, Islam.
And partly it's just demography, that they have a large, young, reproductive population having lots of kids. But, you know, I read, this really surprised me, I read a study of young people in the Middle East, and they were less religious, even in the Middle East. So around the world, young people are questioning authority, patriarchy, I hope, and are less religious. I mean, obviously, there's many exceptions to that, but it's a trend.
My guest is Gail Kimble, and her latest book is World Religions in Microcosm, Family Practices Globally. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio, and back with my guest, retired Professor Gail Kimble, and her PhD work is in religion, religious studies, and her books cover various aspects of religions. Her latest is World Religions in Microcosm, Family Practices Globally. So we're looking at a global picture, and you've interviewed people from all over the world. And I'm putting this in quotes, religious churning. And what is religious churning?
You know, that's one of the things that really surprised me about my 28 interviewees is how much they shifted from their childhood religions and very secular Jews became Hindus, that kind of thing. And of their children, only one of a Jewish family, one of their four sons is a very devout, observant, prayer shawl-wearing observant Jew. He was the only child that was really, really religious. So it's the change from one religion to another.
So when somebody leaves the religion, their tradition, they leave their religious tradition, and so this is the label that you're pretty calling religious churning. Well, you say this is pretty common, but who is least likely? What group is least likely to leave their religious tradition?
Well, evangelicals, but even them, they're having fewer people. So one figure I read was 13% of the U.S. is white evangelicals, and that's a decline. Although their political influence has increased hugely with the MAGA movement, hugely.
Well, something that I mentioned reading your book, there's some things that shocked me. I thought, well, gosh, they still do that? You say in your book, Jesuit seminarians, one of your interviewees, Jesuit seminarians are instructed to flagellate themselves with whips and chains. And I thought, that went out in the Middle Ages, didn't it? But he says, that's what they're instructed to do, and to only speak Latin to each other.
Oh. This was an interviewee who lives in L.A. now and was raised in the San Jose area, went to Santa Clara. Well, I was a Jesuit seminarian, but I've got to say that he's in his 80s. Uh-huh. So I don't know that they still do that, but I know that he did it. And they would
even into the 20th century,
yes.
In other words.
Would put chains around their thighs and flagellate with them with whips. And it would be a little note on a bulletin board. Now is the time for this kind of reminder of your sinful nature, I suppose. That's not what the science said.
Well, I'm mentioning some of the labels of things that we might know exist, but maybe not familiar with the label. Now we have a label, for example, for somebody, this act of leaving your religious tradition, religious journey. Now there's something, since you taught college students, here's a label, male drift. What is male drift regarding college students?
Well, some people are talking about a boy crisis, and I think that's kind of a piece of the youth anxiety, depression, mental health crisis. And the drift is that around the world, except sub-Saharan Africa, the majority of college students are women. And if you look at who's at home in their parents' basement playing video games in their 20s, it's not young women. So there's something happened to dismotivate these young men.
Do you know what occurs to me? Because I have heard of this fact that girls are making better grades, and I thought back to my own when I was a high school student, and the math teacher would say, "Okay, how many people got this problem?" My hand would go up because I had done the homework. And there were guys in there smarter than I was. Their hand didn't go up because they hadn't done the homework. So I'm thinking, well, maybe girls just tend to be more obedient, if that's the word I want to use, more willing to follow instructions. And so a teacher loves the student who's following instructions. And here's this guy over here not doing what I'm asking him to do, not doing the homework. So I wondered if that plays a role in the fact that girls make better grades.
Yes. What I think is a very telling phrase that we don't think about, but we say, boys will be boys. Mm-hmm. We don't say girls will be girls. Mm-hmm. So we give boys around the world more permission to goof off, goof around, play, rough house. So they're given more freedom. And in the past, it worked in their benefit maybe, but now it doesn't because girls are surging ahead.
Well, another thing that I was aware of when I was growing up, all my friends, the father worked, the mother stayed home, was a housekeeper, took care of the kids. There was only one friend of mine whose mother actually had a job. And so men now, oh, I don't have to work. My wife will work. She'll bring in the paycheck. And so you say in your book that men are dropping out of the labor force.
Yeah, but I mean, but on the other hand, I had a discussion with I'm working on a new book about youth mental health, and I interviewed a non-binary young man yesterday, and all these are on my YouTube channel, and he said he thinks what's going on is they're not encouraged as men, that it somehow it's been shameful to be masculine, and we hear toxic masculinity, toxic masculinity. So it's like, well, who are my role models? I mean, do we have any as men who are sensitive and achieving and strong?
And there's another statistic, because you have a lot of percentages in your book. You say 45% women say the single cause of their not getting married is because it's hard to find a partner. So if you've got the job and here's this guy, you might want to date him, but he doesn't even have a job. So where am I going to find a marriage partner?
I talked to a young woman yesterday, 25. She said a good friend of hers told her he really loved her, but he hasn't gone to college. He works doing food delivery. So she's not interested in him as a long-term partner. That was just yesterday. And my niece who lives in Denver is single, and she says she can't find a young man on the dating apps or whatever who can carry on a conversation.
Oh, wow.
She'll say, you know, what do you think about this? Or you know how you ask questions. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to do that. And so she blames the cell phone, social media, video games, and laziness, she says. But I mean, that's pretty lame not to. Oh, Bill Maher did a comedy thing about game and about what men need to know to interact with women. It's on YouTube. It's worth seeing. But he says things like, you know, wear nice clothes and look her in the eye, not at her chest. Or I mean, it's called game.
Well, I was surprised. Speaking on who is at fault, we mentioned Tyson, the Australian guy. And one thing that surprised me was he was blaming the Aborigines. They say, we should have done better. We should have helped you guys out. You said that there's so much disinformation, but he's accepting blame for the Aborigines in Australia.
He says that most people in the world are part of the new consciousness and want environmental health and safety and peace and whatever, but we're dominated by the 1 or 2%, and so we lack that kind of power. And he says the only solution is caring relationships. So I guess it's what Gandhi said, be the change that you want to see.
Well, that reminds me of our founding fathers, you know, people like Thomas Jefferson and these people, that they valued science and reason.
Right. They were deists. They weren't evangelical.
Yeah.
And they never said we're a Christian nation.
And this, you said many of our founding fathers, like Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, you mentioned they're being deist, Enlightenment thinkers who believed in reason and science rather than scriptural revelation.
Yes.
And rather than the Trinity. And so we may have a misconception as to the founding of our country, Gail.
Well, that's why education is so important, because if we had good history classes, we would study that. But it's scary because the evangelicals are trying to get the Bible taught in every classroom. And what does that mean? Do you teach it as a literal word of God? Do you teach it as metaphoric and allegorical and fables? Do you teach Old Testament has more authority than the New Testament, if you're Jewish? So we're going down a real violation of the First Amendment. And you know, Louisiana passed a law that the Ten Commandments has to be in every classroom. What about kids who are Buddhists or Muslim?
And each religion, I won't generalize like that, but many religions claim theirs is the best, this is the way. And I found that quote. Actually, it's you're posing the question to Tyson, and you say you're telling Tyson, in your second book, you emphasize relationships, context, and process as salvation. Mm-hmm. Aboriginal culture, now again, you're quoting Tyson, is best way to live that has ever existed on this earth. He's saying, you're quoting him, Aboriginal culture is the best way to live that has ever existed on this earth.
Well, they didn't trash the planet. They lived with nature in a symbiotic, harmonious, thoughtful way.
And then you quote his brother. You quote your brother, it's our fault as indigenous people that the world is dying because we've failed to bring settlers into proper relation, because relationship together is all we've got. So he's saying it's our fault, us indigenous people, that the world is dying. I was shocked.
Oh, yeah, because it's not their fault.
That's what I thought.
I mean, it's the message that Jesus taught of love, care for your neighbor, be like little children. Money's not important. If all the people who think they're Christians read what Jesus said and applied it, we would have an indigenously beautiful world.
And that's not what you were saying. In Judaism, they were promised this guy that would come and be the savior. And a lot of people say, well, here he is. He's this guy named Yeshua that's walking the earth. This is him. And the Jewish people said, no, that's not him. And people didn't want to hear what he was saying, although he was saying what other religions were saying.
But he also critiqued Judaism. He said, I come to do the spirit of the law, not the letter of the law. He broke all kinds of Old Testament taboos of doing theology discussions with women, healing women with issue of blood. He didn't care about the letter of the law, but the spirit. So he was a true revolutionary feminist.
Well, since you're mentioning this Yeshua, Jesus' relationship to women, you refer to in your book Magdalene Path. And I had never heard it called Magdalene Path. What is that?
Well, it's so interesting. I discovered doing research for this book, there's kind of a cult around Mary Magdalene. So later church fathers tried to convey her as a prostitute, which mm-hmm, she was not. Mm-hmm. But she was she was one of the women who traveled around with Jesus and was supportive of him. And what later thinker said is that she and Jesus married, had a daughter named Sarah, lived in France or England, and now there's kind of a cult of books and schools that teach you how to do Mary Magdalene healing. So you can draw you can draw on her energy to do your healing spiritual work.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with retired Professor Gail Kimble, and her latest book is World Religions in Microcosm. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Gail Kimball, whose latest book is about world religions. So we've been talking about these religions all over the world. You've interviewed how many people? 28 people,
yep.
Would you say? Yeah. A lot of interviews to get opinions. And you were just mentioning that Mary Magdalene is now kind of a subject of worship herself, but you also bring up Egyptian figures that I recently interviewed an Egyptologist. He lived in Egypt to study these things and realizing, oh gosh, some of these things, like we give credit to the Greeks. Well, where did they get them? Egypt. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned something that I found interesting, that Isis ritual requires a balance of masculine and feminine.
And the people in the Mary Magdalene cult, shall we call it, say that Mary Magdalene and Mary, mother of Jesus, studied in this Isis cult, and that it involved tantric sexuality. So for in religious versions of tantra, the union of male and female in the sex act is a symbol for the union of God and us. It's kind of like the Song of Solomon's in the Old Testament, very erotic but symbolic of love and union.
Now, I've mentioned Tyson Yunkaporta. He refers to logical fallacies. Now, is that it seems like you're talking about opposite things. If it's logical, that means it's got to be true. And yet he says logical fallacies are false. So why did he refer to logical fallacies, Gail?
He criticizes himself for making some logical fallacies in his first book, Sand Talk, and for being too black and white, indigenous, nature, natural, good, settler, pharmaceuticals, bad. But he says it. He needs Western pharmaceuticals because he's bipolar. Living in the urban environment, he needs the meds. And he has two kids who are neurodivergent, who knows what they need. But he says that he faults his own extreme illogic logic.
Mm-hmm. He's criticizing his own first book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I love him.
He's saying, and then he says, you start to see these things and wonder where these flawed logics come from. So he started studying logical fallacies. And he also says, I guess certainty is the enemy.
Mm.
And I thought, boy, these days you can't be certain of anything.
Right.
I don't know if I would label it an enemy, but...
Well, if you think of politics, we're pretty extreme in our certainty that our candidate is going to save democracy or the other candidate is going to destroy democracy, and we have the opposite beliefs, but the same ones.
Well, speaking of this, Tyson says, disinformation is the number one existential threat.
Mm.
Disinformation is a threat.
Right. And we can think about it, how it influenced the election of Trump over Hillary, that disinformation flooded in from Russian-backed trolls. So who knows if that made the difference. And we'll see it in this election as well. And now all these crazy conspiracy theories that somehow Joe Biden is behind the assassination attempt, when it was just the typical bullied outcast boy.
Well, the things that you're saying, too, is every day there's a new poll saying, well, what do people think about this? By the minute, there's a new poll. And Tyson says something that I thought, what? Is that possible? He says he does not trust polls. And he says he doesn't trust, one of the reasons he doesn't trust polls is he says that most polls are conducted on landlines. And people nowadays, I don't know people's landlines. Everybody I know has a cell phone. So is this just in Australia that polls are conducted on landlines?
No, I've heard that it's true here as well. I don't know that it's true, but I've heard it. We need to check.
From what he said, he didn't say it's just in Australia. So, gosh.
And the other thing that's fascinating to me is what he said, that whatever happens here, it takes 10 minutes, and they're doing the same kind of woke is bad, same kind of trends, incel, the crazy anti-women men, whatever it is, the strange trend is, it travels.
I thought it was amusing because he said in the past, Australia was 10 years behind the United States. Something would happen, and 10 years later, it would take place in Australia. But then he said it got shorter and shorter. He said, now something takes place in the United States 5 minutes later. We're doing it here in Australia.
That's social media, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Well, while we're on the subject of Tyson, there's a part that I guess charming maybe is the word, but he points out a group that we tend to ignore, or they crawl across our picnic table.
We squish them.
Yeah. And so I would like for you to read what, this is Tyson now, this is Australian Aborigine, what he has to say about this little group, this little colony.
I asked all the interviewees to end their chapter with a centering tool.
But we don't know that. When you write this part, we don't know that until we get to the end of the chapter.
Right, but this is also his centering tool.
Yeah.
You learn everything from the ants.
From ants.
A-N-T-S. Larger animals can shape waterways, but ants maintain them. For example, in the Northern Hemisphere, the activities of wolves can change the course of a river because they're directing the herds there, here and there, with pack hunting. And even where they place their scat, to direct the game's trails downwind. The beaver's doing their thing. The bear's eating the salmon. Give trees things they need, because if bears are not dragging the salmon off and eating them in the forest, eventually those trees will die. The river will change its course if they change their feeding habits, or the salmon change where they're congregating. All these things are responsive, but your ants are constant. If ants hold, then the system can return to balance always. And I found an article similar about ants changing natural pathways in Africa.
This was Gail Kimball reading from her book, World Religions in Microcosm, Family Practices Globally. And now, since you mentioned the topic of ants, that that he talks about earlier in the book, and then at the end of each, when you interview somebody, you say, well, what do you use for centering? So why don't you go ahead and read what he says is when you ask him.
Okay. See the ant, again, A-N-T.
So this is what, when you say, Tyson, what's your centering tool? And he says, okay, here's what you do.
Okay, so everybody needs to practice this. Promise me you'll practice. Seek the ant view of things, which may mean you've got to lie down and press your cheek to the ground and look at something from that angle. Once a day, check around your house and see what the ants are doing. Once you start following the ants, you'll start to follow the water. Even when the water isn't there, you'll know where it's going to flow. If you continue to follow those flows, you'll be in the system. You'll be moving with it, trying to extract things and scale them up for your own magic or spiritual purposes. You'll be in spirit, which is basically just bioinformatics, which is his word for the law of the land. Bioinformatics signals, a scientific way of interpreting that. That's a spiritual secularization for you to apply daily. So we all need to lay on the ground with our cheek and look at the ants.
Well, you don't even have to do that, because when the weather is nice and I take my yoga mat and spread it out on the grass in my front yard, and often a little ant will crawl across. And I've been surprised at myself how fascinating it is just to watch this little ant or another insect, a fly even. But to just really pay attention to what that little critter is doing. Bees are another insect that I think people value now.
Yes.
More than
ever. Oh, yes.
So another thing that comes up in this chapter with Tyson is that we think snakes are evil. Oh, yeah. Because we've read Genesis. That snake is evil.
It's a tempter.
But what does Tyson say about snakes?
Well, his next book is with his wife, who's getting her PhD, another Aboriginal.
He has a PhD, by the way. I don't know if we mentioned that.
No, I didn't. And he has two masters like me and a PhD. and by the way, he got it to try to deal with the prejudice against Aborigines in education
system. Of which
system.
He was one. Is one.
Is one. But in terms of their book, they're working on the Great Serpent. And they think of the Great Serpent as creator, divine, and they're doing a lot of imagery, art portrayals. And when I was teaching energy tools in Japan, and I told them that in my system, snakes are seen as negative entities. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, for us, like the white snake is good fortune and good luck. So, yeah, it's different.
Yeah, and so they don't believe these older cultures that weren't invented 5 minutes ago in a monastery. They don't believe that snakes are evil. Right. They have snakes as a foundation of, and this law that you use, with rainbow serpent or dragon. And what came to mind for me when I was reading this was the medical profession's symbol.
Oh, right. The caduceus is a serpent. And it's also Kundalini Yoga with the Ida Pingala Sasunya, which is tantric sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there are things I think that will people will find interesting in here. And one of the things that I think people will maybe, I don't know, it's kind of scary maybe is the word. Stephen Hawking, he's a physicist. He's a well-known physicist. Stephen Hawking warned, and he did this in 2014. Now, this is in your book, 2014. He warned that AI could spell the end of human race.
I think about that because if AI says...
Maybe we should say what AI, I think most of
them artificial now, intelligence, that if they figure out that human beings are a pest, destroying the planet, which we are, then their intelligence might lead them to the logical conclusion, let's eradicate these pests that are destroying the environment. And the other thing about AI that I think people haven't thought about enough is the computers consume an enormous amount of energy, just like with Bitcoin and whatever. It's enormous consumption of energy.
And meanwhile, we're patting ourselves on the back. Oh, we're being so ecologically wise now, and we're saving
No.
And yet here they... Just like what you just said.
You know, something interesting is Melania Trump wrote probably an AI-generated message in terms of the assassination attempt. It'd be worth people reading that because it's so stilted and AI-ish. Mm-hmm. You can see the difference between a human brain and a AI brain.
And it's hard to tell when they're telling, when they're accurate and what they're telling is true when it's not.
Yeah. Right.
Maybe you're glad you're retired now because your student may be handing in papers that were written by a robot.
But they have ways of checking. So the robots can check on the robots.
And, you know, when I saw the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, I thought, that's total science fiction when HAL took over. Oh, my gosh. You have percentages on how many people feel a connection to somebody who had died. Passed on, and you give us 38% of people feel a connection to somebody that passed on. You say that 83% of adults believe in a soul, and that's related to this fact that the fastest growing group is the spiritual but not religious group. And yet they believe this, but you say quote, 27%, only 27% believe in reincarnation. And I think that, too, is culturally related.
Right, because I think traditional Christianity and Judaism doesn't believe in it. So the Western ethos is when you die, you go to heaven or hell, I guess.
But, you know, sometimes I wonder about the New Testament. There's a question.
In my father's house, there are many mansions.
Or they say, well, who do you think Elijah was?
Oh, he was John the Baptist. So, yeah, there are definitely references to it, but they're ignored.
Well, I think maybe the editors just, whoops, We missed that one because we don't know what we got was how heavily edited it might have been.
We know it's been translated and written by hand by scribes, and Nicene Council changes this and that. So, yeah, we know that.
Well, we just have even scratched the surface of your book, Gail. Our mind readers, I mentioned, this is 400 pages, but there's so much more in there that we did not cover. Taoism, for example, there's more to that than the I Ching. So I want to remind people again the title of your book. And so if they're interested in recent percentages of what's really going on that we might not know, that they'll want to read your book. So
can I also say that my new book is about teen mental health? So if there are people who would like to talk to me about that, it's counselors, therapists, teens, I would love to have them talk to me, and they can look at gailkimble.info online.
Okay. Gail Kimble, and that's spelled GAYLEKIMBALL. So if you'll Google that, she would like to hear from you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Again, your latest book is World Religions in Microcosm, Family Practices Globally. The author is Gail Kimble. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Spaghettis. It looks like we made too much pasta. Indeed, about 3 cups worth of poorly strained angel hair still sat in the bottom of the pot. Angel hair pasta is a great backpacking choice because it cooks fast. Granted, it is hard to eyeball dry pasta and make a prediction as to how many servings it will yield and how hungry everyone is going to be. We were 7 miles from the trailhead, on a large granite sheet overlooking the Kern River in the southern Sierras. As serious leave-no-trace hikers, we were also in a quandary. We weren't going to bury the food, and we hadn't made a campfire to burn it. Adding additional intrigue to our few options was that we had already realized there were no tall trees nearby suitable for hanging our remaining food items, including breakfast, lunch, and snacks for the next day. As we were lacking a bear canister as well, we had made the rather unorthodox decision to tie a rope to a nearby sapling and then let the food dangle 15 feet down against the granite cliff and 30 feet above the boulder-strewn river and hope for the best. In the end, we put the lid on the pot of pasta, tied the rope to the handle, and dangled that too. Morning came without incident. No bears, raccoons, or other varmints discovered our food bags or the pot. However, the pasta was still there, needing to be dealt with. We had no desire to pack it out, and besides, we wanted to use the pot to boil some water for oatmeal. The angel hair had congealed in the bottom of the pot and looked like a mess of blonde worms. Luckily, we had butter. My two hiking companions watched warily as I fired up the stove and melted a generous chunk of butter into the skillet. I cut the pasta mass into quarters and carefully transferred them to the pan, sautéing them to a golden brown. We called them spaghettis. They were quite good. Jeremy Miller.
Ode to ignoring a job ad. Pale sign on cemetery's back fence calls, now hiring, no details, like the wage, benefits, duties, just 2 words that make me hide behind a laugh. Would my boss demand total discipline, no motion, nothing that would disturb ants, beetles, fungi, grass, daisies, worms? Employees whose work is to be dead, lie on your backs, let time leave you alone. You'll need talent for this lack of heart and thought. Then no feeling in your lips, skin, even your groin. I'm so glad I don't need this work. I couldn't record birds and their songs without my hearing and sight. I'd be useless monitoring weather if my mind were so gone. Gardening could be tough with numb, still hands. Could I be a travel writer sending dispatches from the next world? Intriguing, but so far no one's work has arrived, presenting the afterlife in an email. I'll find earthbound adventures to describe, so bye-bye sound. You'll find folks with no choice. They'll flock to you. For now, I'll run away. Paul Beltz.
A bird just hit the window. The world forgets broken things. It's too late to truly learn again, to fly. The air must love you back, must want you, with the same heart it wants the rain showers and sunbeams. To hold the morning fog as a lost child found. Wind must love the feather, to dance the ether, and seduce the velvet song to sing wild and free. How words want to be calm and are betrayed by an urgent tone of panic and the deep knowing, the instinct that your sky has left you, liftless and lost in the song, now but a cry. Come back. Don't leave me. Please don't leave me. Invisible vapor across the eye that now clatters away through the autumn leaves. Soft down now still. Out of place on the patio stones, the broken wing trying to catch the spell again, panicked in the spent magic of a drowning heart. Lovers are content to leave. Gravity is the heartbreak to hollow bones. Mike Waltz.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.